This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. They have fluttered across the surface of this planet for more than 300 million years. And boy, are their wings tight. No, I'm sorry. The dragonfly is celebrated for its jeweled body and elegant flight. Talking about dragonflies, and long before humans walked the earth, the wingspan of the dragonfly stretched nearly 3 feet wide. This year, North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences is celebrating the many facets of the dragonfly. Bugfest 2017 takes place this Sunday in Raleigh. It's free, where visitors can see and taste a variety of insects, including the dragonfly. Joining me now is Christine Goforth. She is an entomologist and the head of citizen science for the museum, also known as the Dragonfly Woman. Chris, welcome. Good to have you here.
I'm glad to be here.
You've got bugs on your dress, too.
Lots I do. Lots of bugs. I'm kind of nerdy that way.
But there's no, I don't see a dragonfly. We'll talk more about that. I want to introduce Zach Lemon, though, first. He is an entomologist. He is the curator of animal collections for the Audubon Butterfly Garden Insectarium in New Orleans and also an expert insect chef. Hello, Zach.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for having me on today.
Good to have you. Chris, let me ask you, how you got so involved. What got you interested in the dragonfly? Because I think that is worth telling, and will tell us why we should all be interested.
Sure. I got interested in dragonflies in high school. I was in 4-H and did the entomology project in high school after a couple of years of collecting bugs just as a hobby. I got really into the dragonfly specifically because people just didn't have them in their collections in their 4-H projects. And so I wanted to be the person that had dragonflies in my collection. They're hard to catch, and so people just kind of overlook them. But over time, traveling to a bunch of different ponds and streams, catching dragonflies, just watching what they do, I learned how fascinating they are and think they're amazing, beautiful creatures that are well worth the attention.
Very cool. Zach, your love for bugs, I guess, started in grade school. You led a lot of overturned, there were a lot of overturned rocks in your neighborhood, I understand, because of you.
Yeah, I don't think I was the neighbor's favorite visitor because I wouldn't knock on the door and ask if I could turn over the flagstones. I just would. But that was always a great place to find all sorts of wonderful little ground-dwelling insects.
Well, tell us about the dragonfly. You know, Chris is saying that it's hard to catch, which surprises me just because it's so big. I would think that's – and I know you catch a lot of them because we'll talk about dragonfly cuisine in a moment. Why are they hard to catch?
Well, they're exceptional aerialists, and Christine may know a lot more about dragonfly flight than I do, but I have read that they are the only insect in the world that is capable – excuse me, the only animal in the world that's capable of flying forwards, backwards, sideways, straight up, straight down, upside down. They can do a 360 over their body and resume flight. They can belly roll. They can hover motionless. They can glide. They can go from – no speed to about 15 miles of acceleration, 15 miles an hour in a matter of a couple of seconds. And they just twist and turn and juke and jive in amazing ways. So to get back to capture of dragonflies, which you alluded to a minute ago, my suggestion to folks who are interested in catching them is note that different species like to cruise versus perching. You want ones that perch, and because catching them when they land is a lot easier. And again, they're habitat specialists, and so certain species will only fly over water. Others fly over land. Some only perch or fly 30 feet or higher, and some land often and at ground level, and those are the ones I target.
Chris, tell us more about the variety among dragonflies. How many species are there, and what's the variety and scope of their habitat?
They're found most places in the world. There's over 5,000 species worldwide. In the U.S., we've got over 500 species, and they are found in a variety of different habitats, so you'll find them anywhere there's water for the most part, so ponds, streams, rivers, marshes. They have been known to live in very brackish water as well on certain islands, especially, you know, out in the Pacific. You know, there's not a whole lot of fresh water, so they're perfectly capable of reproducing in some pretty salty water. So they're found lots of places all over the world.
Reproduction, they have some fairly strange habits.
Yeah, so they are aquatic insects, and that's why you see them frequently near water, at least the males. They tend to be the ones that you see around water the most. But they really depend on water for their reproduction. So eggs of dragonflies are laid in the water or sometimes right above the water. And then when they hatch, they'll fall into the water. And then the immatures, the nymphs, are going to live underwater for actually the bulk of the dragonfly's lifespan. So they're aquatic. They're running around on the bottom, eating other insects, small tadpoles, frogs, things like that, and just doing what they do in the water.
The female is interested, certainly, in fertilizing the eggs, but also not so much interested in the uber attention of males. Apparently, they get just too attentive, and she's got to figure out a way to cool these guys down, right?
Yeah, so females tend to choose which mates they're going to mate with based on where a particular male is located at a pond or another body of water. So they are going to find a place that they want to lay their eggs, and then they'll mate with whatever male has control of that. There's a lot of competition between males to attract females and protect these spaces where they're going to want to lay eggs. And so what ends up happening is that a female that flies to a pond or a river or stream, wherever they're going to be, tends to get just bombarded by males that are interested in mating with her. So there'll be the male that's, you know, at the habitat or this exact spot where she wants to lay her eggs, but then there's all these others that are in the area that are competing as well. So they get harassed pretty badly. A lot of times the females don't spend much time near the water. They're going to spend a lot more time away from the water, feeding, doing their own thing, and only come to the water just because they don't like being bothered quite
and
so much.
And is it like the male has scoped out some territory, so they're all kind of evenly spaced? Then when the female says, that's the spot I want, now the guys are saying, well, that's where I should have been.
Yeah,
and that's when the fight starts, right?
Yeah, and they do fight even if there's no female there. So they're just trying to figure out who is the best, and they get the best territory, and the next best dragonfly gets the next best territory, and they kind of divide it up according to who's the strongest and best. But there's always males flying around competing with the other males. They're trying to usurp territories from better males or gain a territory that they haven't had. So there's always this competition between the males to get the best spot, and it's entirely driven by the females that are going to come lay their eggs. So,
but they've got this is complicated because, you know, you think about some other animals that compete this way. It's like, I'm the male and this is the way I've developed, and a female is looking for the biggest antlers or the brightest red crest or something, and that, you know, for adaptive reasons is some indication of how good my genes are. That's all. It's a very passive thing. I happen to be this way. You know what to look for in a guy. You find me, then we have eggs. But this means that the male actually has to know what the female wants. Like, she's going to find this spot because it's the safest, it's the deepest, it's the closest to food, whatever she's looking for. He has to be a little bit empathetic. Empathy is not the right word here, but
he needs to know what kind of conditions are the best for the eggs and then defend that space from the other males to be able to have any real chance of mating.
And you talked about, Zach, these flight patterns, and I guess they're designed to hunt. Tell us about the variety of prey that they look at, because they're actually pretty useful to us as humans who may not, say, like mosquitoes. So tell us more about what they eat, Zach.
Right. Dragonflies hunt on the wing, and what they do for prey capture is really quite interesting. They're typically going to go after bugs that are smaller than they are, but they can take things their own size. And in fact, cannibalism is not uncommon with dragonflies. I actually got some decent photographs of a dragonfly eating another dragonfly a couple of days ago, and again just a couple of weeks ago. So if it flies and a dragonfly spots it and can catch up to it and assesses it to be small enough to tackle, it'll tackle it. But what's really neat is that if you magnify the legs of a dragonfly, they have long spines coming off of each side of all six of their legs. And when they've spotted something that they want, what they will usually do is catch up to it, and they will position all six of their legs so that these spines are touching each other and effectively making a basket. And as they fly up to the animal, it gets caught in this basket, and the dragonfly reaches down simultaneously and bites the animal with very large and powerful jaws. And that's how they engage in prey capture. Although, as long as we're talking about it, that's fascinating in and of itself. The nymphs of dragonflies are ambush predators, and they also will capture things that are swimming in the water column, but they have what is effectively a hinged lower lip, and there are some really, really good videos of this, not many, but some, that you can find online, where this extended body part sort of unhinges and comes out almost like a glorified trash grabber with jaws at the end that grasp. And it's fascinating to watch the nymphs hunt as well as the adults.
Well, the other fascinating thing – go ahead. Finish that thought.
Well, I was just going to say, getting back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier with regard to capturing dragonflies, if you have it in you to do more than just observe them with binoculars, which is fantastic and fun to do, and you get a good aerial net, nothing will humble you like having a dragonfly 2 feet from you and swinging your net as fast as you can and not coming anywhere near it. And it happens all the time.
It's kind of like in the cartoons where they're looking at you and then you can almost hear the wah-wah when you go, because they can go up and down and backwards.
Absolutely.
Right? And they're looking at you like they're steady. They're in the air. They're actually hovering. So what could be hard about this giant bug hovering in front of me? And then wah-wah-wah-wah and off it goes. It's kind of
like I said, 0 to 15 miles an hour in a heartbeat.
Talk more about the we were just talking about the nymphs a minute ago, Chris, and there's an amazing sight when this thing breaks into adulthood, right?
Yeah, so they have to get out of the water before they turn into adults, so they tend to crawl up plants and rocks and other things that are coming out of the water, and then they will break out of that last exoskeleton from the nymphal stage and have to pull out their entire body. Insect molting like this is really cool. They're pulling out their digestive tract and their respiratory system, their entire reproduction system, so there's the whole body is basically getting pulled out of this exoskeleton, and then they have to puff up their wings. They have to puff up their body, make it the size and shape it's going to ultimately be, and then wait for all of that to harden up so that they can move around. They do tend to be really vulnerable during this time because they can't really move very effectively. They certainly can't eat anything. They can't fly away. So if birds or other predators notice them, that's a time where they're really at risk of getting eaten by something else.
Probably what mom is, part of the thing mom is looking for, where can they crawl up and be a little bit safer in this vulnerable time. By the way, we have videos on our website, stateofthings.org. I would say not during lunch, particularly for that one, because while it's amazing, you know, it's a graphic in a way that might disturb you. Like if you're eating pastrami, you're thinking. By the way, they also talk about shedding. They do this quite a bit, right? Because they have to get bigger and bigger. Is that right? Or they shed often?
Yeah. So most insects molt as immatures, usually between like 4 and 6 times. So, you know, they molt and get a lot bigger every time they molt. Dragonflies start off as these teeny tiny little eggs and then become these very large insects at the end. They tend to molt a lot of times compared to other insects. So it's 20, 30, 40 times. So they're going through this molting process, which does make them vulnerable and is kind of stressful. And there's all kinds of problems that can happen when they're molting, and they do it a lot. But they're going from a teeny tiny little egg to a very large insect at the end. So that's how they have to do it to get to that ultimate size.
Well, however incredible, however vulnerable, and however complicated all this sounds, they've been quite successful for a very, very long time. We think 300 million years, maybe? Is that possible?
Yeah, there's a good fossil record for Odonata, the group that contains the dragonflies and the damselflies, going back several hundred million years.
So what was that? But they were much bigger, we think.
Yeah, so in Kansas, there's some really great fossil beds that have turned up these giant damselflies or dragonflies that have been recorded to have a 3-foot wingspan. Yeah, so they're huge. We don't have anything that big now, but in the past, we had some pretty large ones.
We kind of think that there must have been more oxygen in the atmosphere when these first were flying around, right?
Yeah, that's the prevailing theory at the moment, that you know, insects are limited in their body size currently because we have a certain atmospheric level of oxygen that can't support them getting any larger. They have a fairly passive respiratory system, so that oxygen is somewhat just flowing into their system. They can pump it in and out a little bit, but it's not like our lungs, and they're not transferring oxygen from a organ to the rest of their body. It's just kind of flowing in. So they're really limited by how much oxygen is in the environment, and that determines how big they can be. In the past, in the Carboniferous period, when these giant dragonflies were around, it's thought that there was a much higher oxygen level on our planet, and so that they were able to get a lot bigger. They could get oxygen to the center of their body a lot more effectively than they can now, so they were able to be quite a bit larger.
So they're amazing animals, Zach, and you're telling us that they're also kind of tasty, huh?
Yeah. when you said, don't look at these pictures during lunch, I thought, well, he obviously doesn't have a picture of my Odonata hors d'oeuvre on there.
Well, I just,
that's a fantastic
one. I mean, eating them is fine. It's just sometimes in their processes. That's some of the stuff. But tell us more about those hors d'oeuvres and about dining on dragonflies.
Well, I've been cooking bugs for 20 years. And at one point, I don't know, maybe 10 or a dozen years ago, a coworker of mine said, you ever thought about frying a dragonfly, and I hadn't. So thank you to Koki for that. I treat them kind of like you would a fillet of fish. I hold them with these very delicate little tweezers by the wings. I have frozen them, of course, so these are not live dragonflies. Right. But I'll run them through an egg wash, and then I'll dredge them in seasoned fish fry and put them in oil on a medium heat for about a half a minute per side. And at the same time, in another pan, I'll sauté some very thin slices of mushroom. The fried dragonfly goes on top of the mushroom. I drizzle a little Dijon soy butter on top, and it tastes like soft shell crab. And it's really, really good. And there's a lot of sweat equity involved in getting these dragonflies. So since this is not a bug that gets farmed where I can just call someone and say, I need 10,000 dragonflies tomorrow. So I've been out in the swamps and marshes of Louisiana a fair bit over the last couple of weeks trying to get a good 120 or so for the evening portion of Bugfest this weekend.
Well, and they are quite appetizing. We will have pictures of those on the website too, stateofthings.org, and you'll see them. And they are. I mean, well, you think about it now. It's true that these insects are related to crustaceans. I mean, and aren't they? So it shouldn't surprise us when you make comparisons to crab and lobster. But I will tell you the truth. Dragonflies have always looked tasty to me. The idea of just sort of grabbing them by the wings, dipping them in a beer batter, and putting them in oil has always been appealing to me. I will tell you. They're good.
Well, now, then you're thinking like a good entomophagist.
Now, and the fact is, people, I mean, look at this. These are protein. People all over the world eat bugs. We're being silly, but they're good protein, right? And people do eat them.
Both of those things are true, and I will say that the general baseline knowledge that everyone seems to have is that a lot of the percent of an insect's body is made of protein. And while that's not inaccurate, what is now coming to the fore is that there are a lot of other nutritional benefits to eating insects. There haven't been labs until fairly recently, one in Mexico several years ago, and now one in the Netherlands, that are devoted to looking at insects at a nutritional level. And many different kinds of insects across the board have very high levels of iron, phosphorus, calcium, riboflavin, niacin, and thiamine, just to name six things, all of which are important and needed in our bodies. So you could do an awful lot worse than having an insect-based diet. And to the extent that we love the taste of crustaceans, I would suggest that anybody who hasn't had a well-cooked bug ought to try one.
Now, the downside, though, and I'll ask Chris this question, is that they are fairly beneficial. I mean, after floods, but any time, these particular bugs do suck up a lot of mosquitoes, don't they?
Yeah, I like to think of dragonflies as a really kind of a balancing force in nature, so that they are helping control the populations of a lot of other insects, especially things that we don't like, you know, like mosquitoes and black flies and other biting insects. A lot of those are aquatic insects as well, so they're coming from the same habitats that the dragonflies are occupying, so they provide a really huge service for us in controlling some of those pest populations of things that we don't like. Of course, they eat some other things too. They're eating other dragonflies and bees and some other things. But they do provide a really essential service for people. When you see flooding in areas, you know, you tend to get really big increases in the number of mosquitoes and other biting insects. And a lot of times you'll also see a whole bunch of dragonflies come into that area, and they'll just kind of take care of all of that, get everything back down to the normal kind of population levels, and return the balance back to the way it is supposed to be.
Now, I wonder if there are some reasons, apart from Zach and his net and egg wash, that the dragonfly might be endangered. Are they endangered, or should we worry about them?
Insects get ignored a lot with endangered species lists just in general. There is one species that's listed in the U.S. that's endangered. It's the Heinz emerald. It's found in the upper Midwest in the U.S. and like Michigan, Wisconsin, Illinois. It is really small population sizes. The last time they did an estimate, it was about 3,000 in one population, about 3,000 in another population. So this one is really particularly at risk of going extinct. It is a marsh-specific species, and so humans don't tend to like marshy habitats. We're really quick to get rid of marshes, and so it's dependent on a habitat type that we don't necessarily like, and so their population size is going down mostly because of habitat loss.
Well, I want to thank you both for being on the program. And, of course, you can find out more Saturday at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. But first, Christine Goforth, head of citizen science for the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, also an entomologist. And you can call her the Dragonfly Woman if you want. Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Zach Lemon is an entomologist and the curator of animal collections for the Audubon Butterfly Garden Insectarium in New Orleans. Zach, thank you.
I appreciate it. I'm looking forward to coming up to Raleigh.
Bugfest 2017 takes place Saturday at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. All the information at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, what would it have been like if Leonard Bernstein were still with us at the age of 100? We take a look at his legacy next. Stay tuned.